Welcome to Local Talk, a program that explores the people, places, and stories of Central Iowa. We're your hosts for today, Susan Franzen.
And I'm Tom Beal.
Today, November 11th, is Armistice Day, commemorating the treaty signed at the 11th hour on the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, which ended the war to end all wars. I'm speaking specifically of World War I.
Well, it's also Veterans Day, a federal holiday that honors the veterans of all of our wars.
You're a war veteran yourself, Tom, aren't you?
I am indeed. I served in Vietnam, but I want to talk more about that later in the hour. For our opening story, our reporter Greta Anderson has a story for us regarding the recent city council election aims. Greta?
Well, hi, Tom. Yeah, in part, during the city council campaign, the housing crisis in Ames was talked about a good deal. During these debates, one of the candidates was promoting an intriguing solution to the lack of housing for low-income and very low-income individuals and families. I wanted to talk to her once the election was over and find out what that was all about.
You've already done some reporting for KHOI about the housing crisis in Ames, haven't you, Greta?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I first arrived in the Ames area in 2006, there was a lot of housing available. I remember people saying that those huge blocks of housing in West Ames that are visible from Highway 30 were largely vacant.
Well, 6 or 7 solid years of growth in the U.S. in the ISU student population certainly changed that.
Exactly. And now we're to the point where ordinary people earning decent wages can't even find a place to rent in Ames. And that's not even mentioning the people on very restricted incomes or working in some of our low-wage sectors. These people may work in Ames, but they find they cannot live in Ames. Or they find themselves one small mishap away from homelessness. It's this injustice that caused a group of us to gather under the umbrella of a Mid-Iowa Organizing Strategy, or AMOS, to see what could be done.
You're part of that organizing strategy, aren't you, Greta?
Yeah. Yes, I am, Susan. And one of the actions this group decided to take was to have each city council candidate address a series of questions about steps that could be taken to create a more affordable housing in Ames.
Yeah, we recently aired the AMOS-run candidate forum on affordable housing in the Heart of Iowa program.
Yes, Susan, you should know because you taped and edited that piece. So you may remember at this forum, one of the candidates, Amber Corrieri, stated that Ames or Story County really needed to form a local housing trust. She said something about state funding, but I didn't really grasp it all at the time. She said she would pursue this goal of forming a local housing trust, whether or not she won her race.
And she did win her race.
Yes, she did. So last Friday, a couple days after the election, I caught up with her to get the skinny on what a local housing trust is.
So you have the tape?
Yep. Here's Ames Councilmember-elect Amber Corrieri's response to my question, what is a local housing trust?
A local housing trust is obviously an entity that is formed at the local level. Some communities in Iowa have it as a county-based trust. Others do it on the city level. And then some of the smaller rural areas will do it as a regional. So they'll combine multiple counties or multiple cities in terms of creating that trust. And then what happens is if you become an approved housing trust, you can receive money from the state housing trust. And essentially, those dollars are appropriated to you to use to distribute to other housing organizations in your community to carry out housing projects for low-income families.
So you're saying that there is state money that we are not accessing because we don't have such a local housing trust?
That's correct. So Story County or even in our region around us, we do not have a local housing trust formed. And there is significant dollars at the state level. This fiscal year 14, there was about $7.8 million that was set aside for housing trusts. So essentially, when you become an approved housing trust, you're basically guaranteed a pot of money every year, provided that you continue to apply and meet the guidelines that they've set. So you receive a base award, and that's dependent on whether you're a county housing trust, a city housing trust or a regional housing trust. And then you receive an additional award on top of that that is based on your population. So you receive, I believe right now this fiscal year, it's $1.75 per capita. So then they would appropriate that money to you on top of your base award. So if we're just looking at someone who's maybe comparable to the Ames area, we'll say like the city of Council Bluffs. They receive their base award of $90,000, and then they receive $1.75 per capita based on their census population. And so they receive a total of $198,000 per year based on those kind of guidelines that the Iowa Finance Authority has set out.
Amber had printed off a map of Iowa showing the numbers of housing trusts in each county across the state. A good number of counties were a dark gray. The vast majority of all of our 99 counties were a medium gray. And then there was Story County, along with Marshall, Hamilton, and Hardin, an island of virginal white on the map, just nothing.
That kind of confirms the sense of your group, Amos, that not enough attention has been paid to the issue of affordable housing in our community.
True enough. We've got some very dedicated and hardworking nonprofits addressing the needs of low-income and very low-income families, but they're just struggling to keep up with the need. None of them really has the resources to rise above the day-to-day emergencies and address the situation. But fortunately, I think we've got momentum on our side. People are talking about this issue now. Amber went on to tell me more about the process of forming a local housing trust.
Okay, let's listen to that. You're listening to Local Talk on Community Radio.
And there's a long series of steps that you have to follow before you can get approved by the state. And it starts with, obviously, the very base thing is forming your nonprofit organization, getting your nonprofit status, having articles of incorporation and bylaws and all those things you would normally do for any nonprofit. And then there's other things that go along with that. So you have to have support from your city or your county, who, you know, wherever you're forming your trust, and that can be done via resolution. And then you would need to have both private support and public support. So you'd have to show that you're a viable entity, whether that's through letters of support or letters of commitment from, you know, private business. It could be support from corporations, family foundations, the nonprofit community. It just depends. If you look at like a Polk County, which is obviously a very significant example because they provide so many services, Polk County receives their state allotment. They also have support at the county and local level. And then they have maybe 20 or 30 private corporations that fund them on a regular basis. Everyone from, you know, the Wells Fargos of the world to Alliant Energy and so on. So, and then based on the amount of money that you receive from the state and then your local community partners, you would then grant that money, and you'd have your own application process to approve nonprofits. So, for example, the Emergency Residence Project could apply for funding to support their homeless shelter, or if they wanted to expand and maybe purchase another property that would serve homeless individuals or families, they could apply for that money through the Local Housing Trust. But really, because the Local Housing Trust would be, you know, a private entity that would be formed independently, they would be able to set their own parameters on how they grant funds, as long as they abided by the state guidelines and made sure that they were providing money to projects that met a certain income level in the community.
How did you become aware of housing trusts?
Actually, through Mainstream Living, my employer, we have an apartment building in Polk County that serves homeless single women. And we receive money through the Polk County Housing Trust to fund that particular project. We receive an amount of money every year, provided that we continue to meet the guidelines and show outcomes and things. And that's really was my first experience with them. And then I just sort of started doing more research because I knew that we were not getting any money in Story County for any of our homes that we have here. And I wanted to know why. And that's kind of what led me down this path. So
Did it have anything to do with your motivation to run for city council?
A little bit. You know, people who know me know I've always been interested in the nonprofit world and addressing the needs of the vulnerable populations that we have here. I worked in banking for a long time and left to work in the nonprofit community, partly because I wanted to make a difference on a full-time basis, I guess. And so city council was... part of that was just my love of local government and my passion for that particular area. But the other side was really because I do feel very strongly about all of the good things that are happening in this community, but there's not enough people aware of all of the issues that low-income families face on a regular basis. And I hope that I can help be a voice for those individuals.
Are you envisioning working with the county and maybe some of the other cities in the county, or do you think focusing on Ames is the right move?
You know, I don't know the answer to that right now. Certainly, we have some great partnerships with the county in terms of the asset process, but I don't know if the other communities have, the other communities in Story County have made affordable housing a priority. And so I just don't know what those conversations would be like. I know that it's a priority here in Ames. We have a lot of very active individuals and nonprofit organizations that I think really are committed to tackling this issue. And so for me, my initial thought says it makes sense to do it on a local level, you know, a city of Ames type organization. But, again, I think we'd have to have some conversations with some other individuals. So,
is there anything else you'd like to say about the Housing Trust and some of the possibilities that you think might be able to be funded through this?
I guess the one thing that I would say is I think it's something that's very feasible for our community. It's not going to be an easy process by any means. There definitely will need to be some serious conversations and some buy-in from a lot of different groups around the community. But we have models that we can look to, and we have some good resources at the state level that we can use to help us move forward in this process. But there's just so many possibilities. When you look at some of the other housing trusts and the things that they're funding, they are using the data that they have and solving real issues in their communities. And they're doing some very important work, and they're addressing the needs of homeless populations. They're looking at addressing the needs of people living with mental illness, children who fall into that low-income category. There are some examples of some housing trusts that just use it for capital projects. Then there are others that will just use it for low-income families who need to do repairs or make modifications to their homes. So you do have some local ownership over what you can do with your funds as long as you're falling into their to the state's guidelines.
Well, that's very interesting. This sounds like even the formation of the trust will be just the beginning of the conversation about what gets funded and how.
Yes. So obviously forming the trust is definitely the first piece of the puzzle. And, you know, as I've said before, I think we do have some individuals who are committed to getting their hands dirty and sitting around the table and seeing what we need to do to get this done. But it will be a significant process. It's not something that we'll just be able to throw together in, you know, a couple of months and then we're on our way.
Well, thank you, Amber, for taking leadership on this very important issue in Ames.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of people who can provide some leadership in this role. Obviously, Amos has done a great deal of research and I think is looking to see what that next step is and finding solutions. And there are certainly some other individuals that we can look to for assistance and help. And through my new service on City Council, I just hope that I can be an additional voice around that table and helping to make progress in this area.
That was Amber Corrieri, councilperson-elect for the City of Ames, talking about forming a local housing trust. And you're listening to KHOI Community Radio. Greta, the angle of having to bring in businesses in the community to contribute to this fund, I think is very interesting. I see what you mean about this being a community-wide effort.
Yes, we have some very talented fundraisers helping us out. And I think the business community recognizes the real crisis we face in this area. I mean, they're the ones whose employees have to commute each day to work.
And that itself could lead to problems in their workforce, people having car troubles or weather-related travel issues.
That's a good point.
Susan, I tell you, it was literally a year ago that our Amos group had its first meeting with a public official from the city. And someone at that meeting said that we planned to be a force to be reckoned with.
Well, it sounds like you definitely are.
Actually, that person who said that was me.
That doesn't surprise me.
We have a great team at Amos, and I'm just one of our more, shall we say, excitable members.
So that's on with Amos's group agenda in the coming year.
Well, I think we all realize this has to be a multi-pronged approach. So one thing we're going to ask council members to do is look at the existing zoning and rental codes and how they might increase the cost of housing. Another piece of the puzzle that we haven't touched on is how the university is going to take responsibility for the vastly increased numbers of students it's bringing to Ames each year. I think the people of Ames need to put pressure on the university and the regents to provide places for these bodies to sleep, without displacing existing Ames residents.
Maybe the university or foundation could help with forming a housing trust.
That would certainly be very well one welcome sign of commitment.
I remember when residents used to take in students in their basement apartments or spare bedrooms, but the rental code has really discouraged that. You have to meet state requirements.
Yeah, there's so many requirements, actually, that our city has put into place for apartments to be made into rental units. But that's what I was talking about when I said the Amos is going to focus on rental codes and zoning codes as well as this housing trust. How can we change the codes that we have to ease the pressure of the student population and allow people to have students living in their basements and upstairs apartments?
And Greta, it's not just students. So you mentioned earlier low-income people in Ames. There are lots of people who are not making much money. They need a place to live. And the prices are simply very high at the newer units.
That's very true. One of the things that we face, a lot of these things didn't just happen by accident. Some of the rental codes that were put into place were kind of discouragements for students, I think, to live in the residential neighborhoods because people had a kind of not-in-my-backyard attitude toward students living in their neighborhoods.
Well, that's a big question we'll have to deal with in future programs. Thank you very much for your reporting, Greta, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more from you on these issues.
You bet. Thanks a lot, Susan. Thank you, Tom.
On Armistice Day, the Philharmonic will play, but the songs that we sing will be sad. Shuffling brown tunes hanging around, and excuses were made. When I needed a friend, she was there. Just like an easy chair. Armistice Day, Armistice Day, that's all I really wanted to say.
Well, Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio at 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We've been listening to an interview by KHOI reporter Greta Anderson with Amber Corrieri, new member of the Ames City Council, about a new rental housing program in Ames. Now we'll turn our coverage to Veterans Day.
Today's holiday began when the fighting ceased in Europe at the end of World War I. And President Wilson proclaimed the first Armistice Day a year later, November 11th, 1919. One of the most famous poems of that war that I think is well worth remembering today, because it brings back so many, many Armistice Days, what used to be called Poppy Day. So, Tom, could you read In Flanders Fields by the Canadian Army doctor John McCrae?
In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row, that mark our places, and in the sky the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders Fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from falling hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields.
Poetry has been a source of solace for many returned soldiers. One living in our community is Dennis Malsby, and we have a couple of poems by him. But we also have an interview with him about his experiences as a Vietnam War vet. This is an excerpt from an interview with Kay Puttock in which Dennis describes his transitions.
I graduated from Grinnell College in 1964, and of course we had the draft then, so I'd received a letter from our draft board about 6 weeks before I graduated saying, what are you going to be doing? And I had about $1.99 in my pocket at the time, so the alternatives were not good. So they told me that either I should cut a deal with the recruiter or I would be getting a letter shortly drafting me into the military. And that, of course, being prime material for the draft, meant that there was very little likelihood of getting a job. So I went and talked to the recruiter and got into military intelligence. I went to officer's training school and became a second lieutenant and was sent immediately to Vietnam. We were combat support for the 25th Infantry, which meant I spent the first 6 months or so in Vietnam actually out living in a Vietnamese village. There were just maybe a dozen Americans there. That was the most interesting part of it, was being there to observe the culture, make contact with the people. Most GIs did not have that opportunity. They weren't billeted in Vietnamese villages like
we did. Right.
So we did have the opportunity to get closer to the people and try to understand them and see the similarities and the differences.
And what was that like?
Well, it was really interesting. Our setup was right in the middle of the village, and so we could look out at all sides and see Vietnamese village life. Of course, it was anything but normal, given the stresses of war. But we got to meet the villagers. We got to we taught some of the kids how to play American football. I think we got along pretty well. The villagers seemed to be trying to do the best they could, and
just
really it was a very bad
situation. Yes.
You could tell the stress on village life, and sure had disrupted things. In fact, the name of the village was Trang Bang, and a lot of people might be more familiar with that community than they think. And there was that classic picture of the young girl running down the road.
Right,
in napalm.
Right.
That was the village I was in.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, you can notice that picture in the background. There is a temple that was the giveaway to me, because I was very familiar with that. That was just on the entrance to the village. That event happened after I had been back for some time. And that was one of the big shocks I got, seeing that picture. And that, the shocks don't stop once you're out of combat. You come back, but the first 6 months back, you release a lot of that you kind of kept in, and those were bad months. I think some of my poetry says it better. Let me read one called Changeling. But getting this out, you know, has really been helpful. And I would certainly recommend any veterans, they try the creativity thing to get rid of those emotions, or to at least have them take form so you can wrestle with them. We pace in the sauna-hot Sagan sun, khakis washed by village women, smell of thick brown jungle rivers. Sweat forces out the stink of rotting plants and mold. 100 men, aroused lovers, worship the taxing bird coming to take them back to the world. We almost float without weapons, ammo, and paddy mud on our boots. A crowd of wrinkled, silence-chained replacements shuffle off the plane. The two groups repel each other, the north poles of magnets unable to touch. Shouts, prayers, and cheers from the loading veterans lapse into catcalls, and "you'll be sorries," tracered at the green troops. A few muffled curses come back. On the return flight, men twitch in REM sleep, sharing bloody, guttering dreams. Clearly, we are not finished sacrificing for our country. At a stateside airport, we roll on the ground, dogs in misplaced ecstasy, and kiss dusty tarmac that smells of oil, vomit, and chewing gum. The drive home takes us through the Iowa countryside. The car is not in a convoy. Unblinking eyes scan the tree lines for the barrels of AK-47s. In wooden masks, my parents say, I move too quietly. Not the same. Their child is lost, replaced by something hollow. It is helpless. In dry acid heaves, it feels repressed fear. Mm-hmm. Snakes squirm loose. The bed sheets weep into shrouds for the dead it can never leave behind.
Before we move on to what is available to veterans of more recent wars, I'd like to play another poem by Dennis. June 6th, Omaha Beach, which was performed with musical accompaniment on NPR's Theme and Variations in May 2004 to commemorate the 60th anniversary of the Normandy landings.
Steht ne Laterne und steht sie noch davor. Dort wollen wir uns wiedersehen. Bei der Laterne wollen wir stehen wie einst Lily Marlin.
My name is Dennis Smallsby. I'm a native of Iowa. I am a Vietnam veteran, which gives me some empathy for veterans past and present and future. I've written a poem about landings at Omaha Beach on D-Day. There were five beaches that troops landed on in Normandy. The Omaha Beach was the hard luck beach, the killing beach. They had 3,000 casualties there, which included 1,000 dead. And the losses were 15 times more than on the other American beach at Utah. Title of the poem, 6th June 2004, Omaha Beach. Against the moon rest sharp-cut shadows of bluffs and scrub trees. An inbound breeze unleashes the memory of gun oil and wet canvas. The wandering voice of Judy Garland creates throaty notes. A milky tide pulls sand from beneath my bare feet. Around me, spirits cluster, field strip weapons, chew gum, and talk in jazz patois. More gather, arriving from all the compass points. From the high ground comes a tinkling piano version of Lily Marlene. Reaching critical mass, the spirits burst out of the surf, run, crawl, and twist across the beach. Hundreds fall, scattered, shredded leaves. The rush breaks and hesitates at the foot of the bluffs, gathering strength, clawing, pushing, lifting each other. They flood over the top to vanish in the sunlight of a new day, drawing in their wake the crashing, triumphant boogie of 1,000
big bands.
Mit dir, Lily Marley. Mit dir, Lily Marley.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and I'm Tom Beal. So far in our program, we've dealt with poetry that was written in response to the experience of war. Now Ursula Rudenberg will be talking with Billy Langham and Luke Jensen, who will introduce themselves.
I'm here with Luke Jensen, who's coordinator of the Story County Commission of Veteran Affairs, and Billy Langham, who is a Master Sergeant?
Was a Master Sergeant.
With USAF, the U.S. Air Force?
Yes.
And he's a retired and disabled vet. Billy has also been a volunteer for quite a while for KHOI and is going to be helping with the interview.
Okay.
But Billy, why don't you first tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I was in the military for 20 years, from 1971 to 1991. I worked in the military intelligence field. I was all over the world. I literally spent 15 years overseas.
And how old were you when you went?
18, straight out of high school. I was drafted.
For the Vietnam War?
Yes. And dodged the draft into the Air Force. There was a lot of people just like me, too, in the Air Force at that time.
You describe yourself as a disabled vet. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I was hurt in a training accident back in 73, which really didn't bother me too much at the time. It was basically a sore back. I found out many years later that I'd actually messed up a couple of vertebrae pretty badly, just getting continuously worse. And I also have quite a bit of hearing loss because my job used to be wearing headsets all the time. So I have disability for both my spine, hips, and my ears.
Now, when you say training accident, what does that mean?
We were conducting training when we had a little bit of a off-the-runway kind of thing.
So you were in an airplane?
Yes.
I see. And the airplane went off the runway?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
On my retirement physical, they said that I had a back injury. I will say that in 1991, when I got out of the service, I went to the VA and was basically dismissed. That everything I was saying about my back injury and, you know, some other issues that I had was not their problem. They basically refused. I spoke with both the VFW and the American Legion, and they tried to help me, but they just couldn't get through to the folks at the VA at that time.
So in retrospect, what do you think was going on?
The whole system was just completely bogged down. There didn't seem to be any care for the veterans. You know, we're just here because we got a job here kind of thing. I can say that all of that's changed dramatically since then.
So how has it changed?
Well, in 2008, I was just surfing the web one day and came across Story County Veterans Association or Veterans Affairs, Brett McLean. And Brett started helping me redo my VA claim. Since that time, I've actually been upgraded to a 40% disability now, which has made a huge difference.
And what does that mean in practicality?
Since it's less than 50%, it means that 40% of my retirement pay is not taxed. The VA now will fully assist me in any medical problem I have. I have no problem with them at all anymore. They've been very good about calling me up and seeing how I'm doing and everything else. And they're just an overall friendly feel in the Des Moines hospital.
So, Luke, you're nodding your head. This is Luke Jensen with the Commission of Veteran Affairs. Why are you nodding your head?
Billy's story is very unfortunately common. A long time ago, for our veterans that would have filed a claim, things didn't go their way. Very often things got lost in the cracks or whatever the story was. And we strongly encourage any veteran that filed long ago, if they were denied, to reopen that claim, because things have moved in the better interest of our veterans here, especially recently in the last few years. A lot of increases in benefits and new benefits, and I just they got a whole different panel of people looking at these things now and to give the benefit of the doubt to the veteran. So I would strongly encourage anyone to go to their county VA office and reopen a claim if they got denied for it a long time ago. There's a variety of VA resources that have greatly increased over the years for our veterans, not just from VA healthcare and disability compensation, but there's There's separate educational benefits, like with Billy's situation, now that he's gotten a rating of 40%, now he's also eligible for vocational rehabilitation. He can now, if he wanted to, go get a college education, maybe a certification course in a specific...
Finish off a regular college degree, too.
Right, yep, and it can even continue into a master's program. Mm-hmm. So there's that opens the door for a lot of things, the way his situation ended up. So, and then on top of that, there's a large variety of different resources for our veterans in terms of counseling, whether it be individual, group, or marriage counseling. Those things have increased dramatically. And there's way more resources, there's way more benefits, and a lot of the military branches don't always tell you when you're getting out of the active duty component what those are. So that's why we encourage go see your VA office in your county, because there's a lot more than I knew about when I got out of the Army. So
a VA office, a county VA office like yours, is essentially acting as a liaison for people in the military to help them understand what kind of services are available that they may not know about.
Correct. Yeah, there's veterans benefits at county, state, and federal levels. And we're an advocate for veterans. I don't work for the VA. I work for the county to help out the veterans in this county with any and every available benefit that they're eligible for.
So who made these changes happen?
Our elected officials started to see, as these problems were more permanent, and today's, you know, with the soldiers that are in the spotlight right now with our Iraq and Afghanistan vets, we didn't want to repeat mistakes of the past where we were just basically kicking them out and good luck to you. And they're already starting to see a problem with veterans unemployment as it was. And some of that was veterans of the past. So they thought, okay, now this is our second chance here to get this right.
Who is they?
State and federal. Yeah, we have legislation passing through the state and federal houses to make sure we don't have a whole lot of veterans unemployment. That's a huge concern for them, always has been. Some of our Vietnam vets that weren't treated very well and lived a hard life after their service in Vietnam, it helps the country as a whole. The federal elected officials, the state elected officials, they realized that, and they implemented legislation to put things in place.
Yep. I've seen an increase of great strides since the current president came into office.
There's so many changes in the benefit of the veteran that we really just want to encourage veterans from all war eras, past and present, to come and see us, because a lot of things have ruled in our favor, which is great. We're there to support you and help you in any way we can.
Luke, could you tell us what your background is and how you came to this?
Yeah, I was in the Army Reserves for 12 years, and I was activated twice since 9/11, been deployed in Afghanistan and country, and my job in the Army was military police. December 2009 is when I came back home to the States and was released from active duty. And I was a deputy sheriff and a detective here in Story County. So my Army job and my civilian job went hand in hand. And I was a detective for Story County, so at the end of my career there.
How did you end up working for the Commission of Veteran Affairs?
Actually, I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, and with post-traumatic stress, holding a position in law enforcement is not recommended by doctors and psychologists and people like that. And that suggestion was actually made that I not be in a position in law enforcement with a diagnosis as post-traumatic stress. So there is job protection laws for our Guard and Reserve soldiers. So as a county employee, the county still needed to provide me with employment, and I, my job with Veterans Affairs has been great, and I'm helping veterans, and I understand that, you know, I understand our young veterans that have been to Afghanistan, and so I think it's a good fit.
I think it's a good thing that the VA now just recognizes PTSD, because in the past they would never.
Yeah. Yeah, in the past they had different names for it, like shell shock and combat fatigue. They really weren't sure what to call it. Mm-hmm. There was soldiers from World War II, Korea, and Vietnam that had a lot of problems when they got back, psychologically, behavioral health issues, had a hard time transitioning and relating to anybody in the outside of the military world. And it affected their quality of life in every sense of the way, whether it was escaping to substance abuse, alcohol and drugs, and they didn't have anything back then for support, counseling, therapist. They didn't recognize it to provide any kind of medication or coping methods to help our veterans relax and get better sleep, all kinds of stuff to help reduce the stress from being in combat and war. And
this is Tom Beal at KHOI, and we're hearing from Luke Jensen of the Story County Veterans Affairs Commission, talking about post-traumatic stress disorder and the services they have for those suffering from it.
They know that it's real, and one thing I think that's helped them recognize it is the military suicides. They're on the rise still, and right now there was an article that was on the cover of Time magazine a couple of months ago. It said one a day, and it showed a soldier in his dress uniform with a bugle ready to play taps, because right now we are on an average of losing one soldier a day to suicide. So it's something that's a huge problem, and they've identified it's a problem, thankfully.
So if somebody comes to your office and says they feel they may be suffering from this, are there services you can offer for that?
Absolutely. There's counseling for vets as an individual, group, or marriage counseling through the Vet Center. There's programs at the VA hospital itself. And then there's also things outside of the VA, the Wounded Warrior Project, Pause and Effect. Pause and Effect provides service dogs to our veterans that have post-traumatic stress.
What does a service dog do?
They're specifically trained. They can actually sense their owner's mood, basically. If they can sense if they're getting irritable, they can sense if they're getting a lot of anxiety, they can sense if panic and things of that nature, or depression even, and they can put themselves in between them and anybody that's close or approaching them as kind of a protective barrier, kind of make sure people don't get in their personal space. They can nudge them and get the focus on them if they sense that their owner or handler is getting irritable. So the veteran starts focusing on the dog because the dog's, you know, nestling into it. I mean, they do amazing things. And a lot of these things cost the veteran absolutely nothing. It's just a matter of them being aware of it. But a lot of times you can't do it on your own, and mm-hmm. and that's why those services are there, because they're not alone. There's a lot of veterans going through those same struggles.
Does the Story County Commission of Veteran Affairs have a website where...
We do. You can go to Story County government there. It's www.storycounty.org, and check out... It kind of covers some of the benefits that we do there, and you can take a look at Brett and I and what we do, and you can come see us at 126 South Kellogg Avenue.
126 here. South Kellogg.
Yep, that's here at the Human Services Building here in Ames. And we can just kind of open the door and educate you, let you know all the different things that are out there.
Okay,
you.
And repeat the website again, please.
It's www.storycounty.gov. I think I said .org. It is right. .gov. It's divided up into the departments, and go to the Veterans Affairs Department, and you'll...
So that's storycounty.gov,
yep.
The Veterans Affairs Department.
Correct.
And do you give information about the services there?
Yep, there's information right there on the web, and it also has our contact information and our address on there. So we just highly encourage surviving spouses, family members, and the veterans, come talk to us, and we'll try to let you know what things are out there for you.
I just came home with a head full of pictures, and I can't say, I can't say. They wake me up screaming in the middle of the night and make them go away, and make them go away. And I might stop drinking, and I might not stop. I might cross over that line. I just want to get drunk and stay that way all the time. I'm walking around with a head full of pictures, and you don't want to know, you don't want to know. They're hanging in the air right in front of my face. Everywhere I go, everywhere I go. Then I might stop doping, and I might not stop. I might cross over that line. I just want to get numb and stay that way all the time.
That was really powerful. If there's anyone listening who needs any of the services mentioned by Billy or Luke, I hope they'll contact the Story County Veterans Affairs Commission.
And for the people who can go online, there's some amazing resources for post-traumatic stress. If you haven't, if you just check PTSD Iowa. The website that impressed me the most was maketheconnection.net with the option Veteran Stories. People can volunteer to tell their stories, and you can read the stories of those people who have already shared them. And they're amazing. I think this is a national website that they're linked
in. You know, we talked earlier, Susan, about how many World War II veterans did not talk about their experiences when they got home, and so their families really didn't know what they had been through. And then later, for some of them, as they got older, they began to tell their stories, and by now it was with to their grandchildren. And so this program, where they have an opportunity now to talk about their experiences, the younger veterans coming back from the more recent wars, could be valuable not only as a therapy for the individuals concerned, but also for their families.
Well, that's a really good point. I noticed on the website that there were some World War II veterans sharing now, and they even had, you know, you were supposed to click whether you're a man or a woman, and whether you, what war you were in. And I didn't follow it enough to see if the stories would be channeled to what you would need to hear. But I found the whole concept really, I wondered, I'd like to hear from some people how it worked for them. If it certainly, just for having some empathy, it's a very, very valuable tool.
Well, you might mention that website again for the folks who didn't get it the first time.
Yes, I will. It's maketheconnection.net, maketheconnection.net, with the option Veteran Stories. Speaking of websites, the KHOI website, khoifm.org, will have a place where this show can be heard. And at the end, we'll have links to the veteran services that we haven't mentioned all over this part of Iowa, as well as we'll now have the link to maketheconnection.net. And another one that I just learned about that's really new, this year, I think, is the Iowa Farm Veteran Coalition. And the organization's probably new, but their first ever conference will be December 14th this year. Let me find the information on that, because I'd like to just read from their website who we are. We are farmers, veterans, agribusiness professionals, educators, and other service providers dedicated to empowering veterans to thrive in Iowa agriculture. We have programs and resources for veterans aspiring to farm. We provide guidance to veterans seeking employment in agriculture and rural areas. We are a network for sharing experiences, disseminating resources, and identifying collaborations. Then there are programs and resources. The Iowa Farmer Veteran Network is the name of the organization. Although I'm a little confused, there are actually two, so I'm not sure why they name the network separate from the coalition. But our network of members and supporters is the heart of the FVC Iowa, which would be the Farmers Veterans Farm Veteran Coalition. Join today to share experiences and learn from others. Their resource guide can put new farmer veterans in touch with service providers to help develop a successful farm operation. Rural America Hiring Heroes. Find the resources and organizations that can help you locate and succeed in an agricultural career. Farm equipment and exchange donations. The FEED program seeks to move tax-deductible equipment donations to new farming veterans. So this is, you know, the
full-scale operation to help.
That's right.
Farming.
And find,
like a good program.
Yeah, find a farm veteran. Learn where you can buy local farm products from veterans. Find a veteran to lease your farmland or hire a veteran for your ag or rural business. Register for the Farmer Veteran Coalition of Iowa First Annual Conference.
And all that's on their website.
On their website.
Well, you know, Susan, this is a day of commemorating, saluting, and honoring our veterans. And so there are a number of events taking place in our community today and throughout the day, so that whenever you hear this program, even if an earlier event is over, there will be something else going on.
Right. And there's, well, why don't you say the first one?
The most significant, I guess, for our community is a program at City Hall at 11 a.m. on today. And the main speaker will be Congressman or former Congressman Leonard Boswell, who served in Vietnam as a decorated Army officer. And he will be speaking, I think, on behalf of all veterans. And there will be a performance of the Iowa Senior Band with singer Jim DeHote. So it'll be a wonderful program at the Ames City Auditorium at 11 a.m. today. And then following that program, there'll be lunch at the American Legion Hall on Main Street, 225 Main Street. And then after that, there'll be a number of other things taking place in our area. Most city and county offices will be closed, and of course, there'll be no mail today. And the public library, however, will be open for folks who want to visit them in their temporary location there in the Lincoln Plaza area. In fact, the library will have a special Veterans Day book sale this morning. Well, actually, all day, now to think about it, starting at 9 a.m. and running until 9 p.m. on today, November 11th. And they'll have a good selection of books about historic wars, military strategy, war heroes, and more. And that's someone calling right now to get more information.
Well, yes. Before we do our outro, I'd like to end on a hopeful note. This is the 1976 American folk song written by Ed McCurdy that's been recorded in 76 different languages. A group of East German school children sang this song as the Berlin Wall was dismantled. And I think, though, we'll hold that until after our outro so that we can really hear it all well.
And could I, Susan, I missed one item that's coming up on Tuesday, the 13th, and that's the first annual Iowa State University Community Supper at 5 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. And that, too, will be held to honor veterans and their families. So that will be at the Great Hall in the Memorial Union. There'll be an event starting at 5 o'clock if you want to come before dinner, and then dinner will be served after that at 5:30. So if you want more information, you can contact Veterans Center at Iowa State. Let me do that correctly. Veterans Center at iastate.edu for more information.
Okay. Well, you have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host today, Susan Franzen, together with
Tom Beal.
The individuals interviewed were Amber Corrieri, Dennis Mousby, Billy Langham, and Luke Jensen. Our reporters included Greta Anderson, Kay Puttock, and Ursula Rudenberg. The show was engineered by Richard Morrison. You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. If you have ideas for our shows or guests, email us at khoitalk@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at at 292-2878 or through our website, khoifm.org. Your participation as audience and your generous donations help make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Last night I had the strangest dream I've ever known before. I dreamed that all the world agreed to put an end to war. I dreamed I saw a mighty room. And the papers they were signing said they'd never fight again. And when the paper was all signed and a million copies made, they all joined hands and bowed their heads, and grateful prayers were prayed. The people in the streets below were dancing round and round, while swords and guns and uniforms were scattered. I dream.